Well, first of all, I would like to thank you. It's an honor to be asked to introduce what we are working on here in this Info-Bio program, the whole ITP community. I also want to warn those people of the Info-Bio program who are here and who have been here already for a couple of weeks that they probably won't hear anything new today. Otherwise, everybody who has been here obviously has noted that we have an unusually large number of talks during each week. That is mainly due to the fact that it's a very, very wide area and we try to cover sort of a little bit of everything. And that will also show in my talk today. I will mainly concentrate on what's going on in these first few weeks of the program. Even in there, in order to stay in the lunch scheme here, I will basically only serve a couple of appetizers and hope that after all these appetizers you still feel sort of content and full. The advantage for you is also if you don't like one specific one, you can sort of skip that and wait for the next course. Okay, so since we are trying to explain biology with methods of physics, or at least parts of biology, the first thing I have to do is I have to tell you a little bit about biology. And we had a whole week of introduction to molecular biology, and I'll try to do 10 minutes of introduction to molecular biology. So the most amazing thing about biology, which I find, is if you look at a cell, what kind of stuff is in a cell? Well, you all know that we mainly consist of water, but the very interesting thing about that is we only consist to 70% out of water. And I say we're only because, of course, in a cell mainly works due to chemical reactions going on in a cell at the end. And if you think about chemistry, you usually think about like a test tube with a solution of some stuff in water. And in that case, you're usually thinking about a situation where you have not 70%, but 99.99% of water. That is volume percent here. And basically, the chemicals are just a little bit in that. In a cell, we actually have only 70% volume of water. And so you can imagine that, I mean, the chemistry in the cell is pretty crowded. So what sort of other stuff do we have in here? We have 15% protein, 6% RNA, 4% ions and small molecules, 2% oligosaccharides, 2% phospholipids, 1% DNA. Okay, so these are the main players, and all of those together basically make molecular biology. So let me just go through what all these are. As you all know, the genetic material is stored in this molecule here in DNA, which, as you can also see, does not make a very large percentage of the cell. And well, although you probably all have seen that sort of picture, let me just go to this picture of DNA here. DNA is a polymer. This is the backbone of the polymer. Polymer means it is a covalent bonded object in which the different monomers, which are called bases, are linked together in one long chain or string, if you want to use that word. And you usually have two of those coming together. You see two independent backbones here, and they form this double helical structure, with here in the middle being the base pairs, and I will come back to those later on in the talk. These are different sort of monomers in here, and their sequence actually contains the whole biological information. The next molecule, which is in sort of scheme of how complicated they are, I would say is the RNA molecule. The RNA molecule looks very similar to DNA, This is a typical example of an RNA molecule. The difference is here, if you follow this backbone around, you see that it's only one backbone. It's not two backbones. In DNA, we have always these two molecules, in most cases, which come together and form this double helix. In RNA, it's chemically very similar to DNA, but it is only a single molecule. So what it has to do in order to form these double helices is make all these loops here and fold back onto itself. And also that I'll explain later in the talk a little bit better. We see something similar in the most important part in the cell, these 15%, which are protein, in a sense that a protein is also a chain, but in this case, it's chemically very different. Here, for RNA, we have a chain of four different bases, and for proteins, we have a chain of 20 different letters. That means we have a molecule which has a backbone from carbon atoms, and then every other carbon atom, there's some side group attached, and these side groups can all be different, and at every position we can choose one out of 20. And well, there are hundreds of thousands of different proteins around in the cell, and they all are distinguished according to which sequence they are. What happens to those is that all these amino acids interact in some sort of interesting way with each other. Some attract each other, some repel each other, and what happens at the end is that this molecule will fold into some structure, like for example this one. So what this picture shows is a schematic drawing of only this backbone of carbon atoms. So you have to imagine that all the rest of the volume is filled up with all these side chains, which attract them each other and repel each other, and together make this the one stable three-dimensional shape of this protein. And I mean, that is really what is at the basis of that biology. I mean, in DNA, you have all the information in one big linear piece, right? A cell is a three-dimensional object, so you want to have three-dimensional building blocks from which you can start constructing machines, basically. Yeah?
These lines, there are always some thick parts and some thin parts. Why is that?
Okay. In a protein, you can talk about different levels of structure. You can, if you look at the sequence, what it will typically form are three different types of things. It can form these helices, which are a very stable structure. They are called alpha helices. It can form sheets. They are not shown here. They correspond to a configuration roughly like that, where you have lots of parallel strands going back and forth, and they are stabilized by bonds which go across here. And then they can have loops, so typically on the outside of the polymers, things like that. And a typical convention in representing these protein structures is to show these secondary structure elements, alpha helices and beta sheets, by these white stripes, just in order to show that there is such a secondary structure element at this point, and to show the loops, which are sort of the connecting pieces, just by thin lines. Okay? So in this way, the cell is able to sort of transform the information, the one-dimensional information, into three-dimensional structures. Okay. Go back to the board now. So how do these players now interact? I will not really say anything about those guys down here, and leave it with these three main players, DNA, RNA, and protein. But as I already said, the proteins are the main functional components of the cell. And they basically make up all the machinery inside a cell. That means things which can exert mechanical forces, things which can catalyze chemical reactions, things which just signal that we have a certain external event happening and bring this information to the nucleus of the cell. All of these functions are performed by different proteins. Now, how do the proteins come from, right? We all know if a cell divides, the DNA gets copied in some way and split among the two cells. But, I mean, where do all the proteins come from? Well, the proteins are actually produced in the cell all the time. If we have our DNA molecule here, with the two strands, then we have a specific sequence here of these bases A, T, C, and G, and some pieces of the DNA molecule will actually, as one says, code for a protein. That means that in the sequence of A, T, C's and G's on the DNA, there is a description of what finally a sequence of amino acids making up this protein should be. And the way it works is that you have always three bases together, which are translated into one amino acid. So you look up which three bases these are. There's a unique code which basically tells me, you know, if this is this triplet, then this must be this amino acid, and then the next triplet is the next amino acid, and so on and so forth. And this is what one actually calls a gene. So if people talk about genes, what they really mean is a piece within the DNA which is coding typically for a protein. But a cell doesn't produce proteins directly from DNA, but what actually happens is that there is a protein, as I told you, every function is performed by a protein. This protein is basically walking along the DNA. While it is walking there, it produces something called an mRNA. The mRNA is an RNA molecule which contains the identical information of this DNA molecule, but it's a single-stranded molecule. So this object here, this protein, basically walks along here, it reads the sequence of letters on the DNA, and it will produce this mRNA. So now this mRNA contains the whole code for the protein.
How does it define
which of the complementary strands? Oh, okay. In order to start, it first of all has to find a specific site which is called a promoter site. And this has a specific sequence. And it's not like you know exactly what the sequence is, but you know sort of roughly what the sequence is. And this is only in one strand. I mean, in the other strand, it will be the complement, and this thing will not bind to it. There's also a so-called start codon. So one of these triplets actually says, well, this is now where this thing starts. And also this will be something different in the opposite strand. But I mean, in general, genes can be in both strands. I mean, it's not that if one gene is here, the next gene could be in the other strand. There's no reason why that could not happen. As a matter of fact, it sometimes even happens that genes overlap, so that sort of this gene ends here and this gene ends here, and they sort of share a piece of sequence. But once we have this mRNA goes through another object that is the ribosome. The ribosome is a collection of lots of proteins and also RNA sequences. And it's again a machine which then takes this mRNA and then this reads these triplets and will produce this protein, which is the sequence of these 20 amino acids. And that's what's going on in the cell all the time. The genes in the DNA are read, they're transcribed into mRNA, and then they're translated into protein. But now you might ask the question, well, we all have very different cells, right? I mean, there are tons of different tissue types in any higher organism. However, the DNA in every such is identical. So if we all have the same DNA, shouldn't there be all the same proteins in every cell? And shouldn't therefore be no difference between all these cells? Well, the solution to that is that in front of every gene, there are lots of other sort of codes where other proteins can bind to. And they sort of implement a certain logic. For example, only if these two are here, we can start expressing this gene. Or if this one is here, but if this one is not there, then we can express this gene. And so what the cell is doing, sort of, it is a big chemical computer with the logic elements implemented in that way, which by changing the concentrations of the different proteins, processes information. And part of this information is, for example, if you want to become, whatever, a liver cell or a piece of skin. Right? Or also every type of external stimulus, if you are used, if you are being starved or not. This will sort of, the signal will go into the cell in terms of changing levels of some protein, and because the level of this protein changes, then the level of this protein will change, and so on and so forth. And so this is a huge network of many, many genes interacting with each other in this way, and thereby basically making the cell live.
What causes the initial breaking of that symmetry between the different cells? I mean, you said sort of at a later stage, the different concentration of proteins binding to that side, but how did that...
Well, they have to exchange sort of molecules, typically these small molecules, which break the symmetry. So they have sort of marker molecules with which the cells can exchange, and so, for example, one cell will start excreting them, and then you start seeing gradients, and I mean, it's a very complicated process in which these things evolve.
It involves
communication between different cells, and that's typically performed through these small molecules and gradients.
The first thing is they find out they're in the surface, right?
Right.
So are these markers part of the DNA? I mean, is the DNA...
You mean these things?
Yeah.
Yes.
So the DNA is not exactly identical? It differs in...
Oh, no. The DNA is everywhere identical. But just these... The markers are always in the DNA. The question is this protein always here? And this will depend on external influences. For example, the presence or non-presence of these small marker molecules, which tell you what you should become.
So this is sort of the same question again, but the process of cell division is itself a symmetric process, and it's only after that, when there's some geometrical difference, like the boundary you were talking about, that gradients start to introduce.
The cell division as such is symmetric.
So it's a very nonlinear system with more than one stable fixed point.
There was a question somewhere back there?
Well, pretty much this question.
Oh, okay. So you have seen a little bit what the role of this RNA in here is. RNA is sort of somewhere in the middle between protein and DNA. Here, we have an RNA appearing, which is basically an information carrier. It carries the copy of the information of this gene. On the other hand, this ribosome itself is a big object which also contains RNAs, which have actually a specific structure in order to perform their function. And RNA is also, for another reason, an important molecule. Here you see, I mean, you have no idea how would you evolve something like that, right? If we have a DNA, well, how does a DNA replicate? A DNA needs proteins in order to replicate. On the other hand, well, how do we, proteins by themselves, they can't really do a whole lot either. They need DNA in order to be continuously produced. I mean, okay, I didn't say that, but I mean, if a protein is sort of in the cell and it's not being reproduced, of course, it's taken apart in order to make all these calculations. Otherwise, I mean, obviously, any calculation would end up with every protein being there. So some people believe that RNA is something which itself has a sequence like DNA, but it can also fold. I showed you this picture of RNA. It also has a three-dimensional structure. And it is known that these three-dimensional structures of RNA also have catalytic functions and other functions similar to proteins. So one idea how this could have gotten started is that actually at some point the RNA was the only element and could fold up and perform function and structure at the same time as being the information carrier of the linear information.
In our cells,
this messenger RNA, it's not clear if the folded character of this messenger RNA has a functional RNA. It could be. Definitely, this picture which I showed you, I don't know if one can... this is called the transfer RNA here. And this has to fold into the structure because these are the guys which actually do the translation between the triplet code of the DNA RNA sequences and the amino acid code. They're binding on one end to an amino acid and the other end to the triplet and therefore doing this recognition. So this thing has to have the structure in order to work. So there are two different sort of types of RNA in our cells nowadays, and I also mentioned this thing here contains RNAs which are structural. They have to fold into what they fold into to fit, just three-dimensionally fit into this machine here to perform their function.
So you were saying there's some protein that starts at a promoter on the DNA and produces this mRNA. What if the RNA is just like one strand of the DNA, what tells that kind of protein to go to the DNA instead of the RNA?
The DNA is, the RNA is sort of only a single-stranded version of DNA, so it's not hard to tell those two apart.
So you see both strands of the protein, even though you...
Yes. This thing definitely, I mean, remember you have this double helical... Okay, you have this double helical structure of your DNA, and the bases are sort of in between here. So this molecule actually must do a very complicated job because, I mean, from the outside you basically only see backbone, and then you have these grooves here, and it has to sort of read inside the groove in order to read out the sequence. And I mean, that's definitely very different from RNA, from which, I mean, the first approximation is just the backbone, and then the bases hang out of it.
So when you said that the RNA is just like a single strand of DNA, you mean information theoretically it has the same information, but molecularly it's a little different. Right?
It's, yeah, but I mean, for a physicist of first order, it's the same. I mean,
yeah, to come back a little bit to the DNA, you emphasized the proteins of promoters and repressors binding to it, but people have proposed other things that happen that are less clear about whether they influence this transcription right. But there's, for example, the fact that sometimes a gene is wound around this other protein.
Right.
Sometimes it's not, and sometimes it's methylated, and sometimes it's
right.
Not. Do people understand whether those things are also just as important or secondary?
I don't know precisely. I mean, I don't think that we have a full understanding of what regulates gene. It's not only on this level. I mean, also in here. I mean, I didn't tell you all the things which actually happen to this molecule before it even gets there. All these things can be switched on and off. Then we have a bunch of things. I mean, is it really always translated? No, it's not always translated. There are things done after it became a protein. That all these things are regulated, and I don't think that anybody really understands the full picture of that.
I have a short comment, if I may. The enzymes actually don't distinguish DNA and RNA just by being single-stranded and double-stranded. They read this small difference in the backbone, and no DNA enzyme can be fooled by double-stranded RNA, which actually does exist.
Mm-hmm.
It is the small chemical difference at the two position of the ribose.
Okay.
The enzyme looks very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there are four bases, and three of them determine an amino acid.
Right.
So you have 64 possible.
Right, that's a redundancy.
Is that many to one, or there's certain combinations?
No, it's many to one. And there are 64 possibilities. You need some to code for start, some to code for stop. But most of them are just redundant copies. So you will notice that if you just look at mutation studies between different sequences, you see that some positions mutate much faster than others because a change in the DNA would not change the amino acid. And therefore doesn't change the biological function. So the code is many to one.
Field protein to decode the RNA, right? You must be careful to do the triplets one after another, and if you move by one third of the triplet, what happens? Can you fix that? Or how many cores there are
in the translation? I don't know. But
I was going to ask a related question, which is it conceivable? Are there sequences which can be read two ways so that they make sense, they give sensible proteins if you shift by one third of them?
You mean really farly overlapping whole genes? I mean, I know that there are overlapping pieces of genes. I don't know if you have really complete parallel.
I think there are pieces of viral start at the same start letter of each triplet.
Start at the same?
So the question is, can you shift within triples?
Start.
What?
Can you shift by one base and still get sensible words?
I mean, I don't think that there are really examples where you have it over the whole length of the genes. I know that there are sort of overlaps where things like that happen. But I mean, I think this is a very complicated design goal. I mean, in principle, I don't think there's nothing which prevents that. But I mean, it's a very complicated thing to design two proteins which are so compatible to each other that one is actually the slightly shifted version of the other. But I mean, over short pieces, like for example, the end of one is the beginning of the next, or two ends come together, or the other way. I mean, that can happen, but I don't think over the whole length. I mean, it's just too hard to design.
I think people did find some example of some virus or cock, which is really helpful.
Over the whole length?
Some virus or length.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if anything, you would expect it in organisms which have extremely short DNA to start with, because I mean they are the most pressed for length.
Could you just give us a typical number for how many base pairs code for a?
Oh, okay, sure. Sorry. A protein is typically 300 amino acids. Well, that's already sort of a longer protein, so up to 1,000. Bases, and for example, the whole human DNA is these 3 billion base pairs. You can have lilies; they have, I think, 30 billion. So then that's about it. And very short viruses are sort of on the order of 50,000. Things like that. Okay.
And how many sort of different cells are supported?
How
many different cells
you can have? How many genes are on a
cell? How many cells are called? How many of those large things you can put on the DNA? How many possibilities to use the same DNA? How many cell types?
Liver, skin, nerve.
Ooh. I don't know. And that certainly also scales with the length of your DNA.
I don't know. How much memory you have?
It's like 200 or 300 or something.
I think there should be. I mean, there are certainly more human cell types than that around. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I mean, genes is sort of. I mean, for example, your yeast. It has about 6,000 genes. Humans, well, people still discuss about it, but it's around 100,000. I mean, maybe it's 30, maybe it's 150 or something like that. I mean, how that would translate in different cell types, I don't know.
Is this mRNA the same molecule as the mitochondrial RNA up to the second order in perturbation
theory? The mitochondrial RNA. I mean, but this M stands for messenger, okay. In that case. In principle, RNA is RNA for chemical purposes. I don't think that there are any further distinctions between different RNA molecules.
You just mentioned what there are about 100,000 genes in a human.
Yeah, that's one of the numbers.
About 3 billion base pairs. So
right.
Most of it's
lots of junk. Yeah. Right, junk meaning we don't know, right?
Oh, okay. So it could have other functions.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really tiny fraction of information.
I mean, the cell plays all sorts of tricks. I mean, I'm getting. I would like to tell you something about what physics can do with that. Right? But I mean, I agree. It's extremely fascinating. Okay, let me just go in one more detail here. In a eukaryote, you typically have that. I mean, basically. More complicated organisms like humans, from yeast to human, we have the genes not in such a linear fashion here. But what actually happens is that we have pieces of genes, the so-called exons, and in between there's junk, the so-called introns, and this junk can be very long. So now you may say, well, that's a complete waste of sequence. But what that actually helps you is now we need a machinery which actually, after coupling it to mRNA, cuts these pieces out in order to make it a reasonable gene. Okay, this is called splicing. Well, now that you have this machinery, you can start and do alternative splicing, which means you can cut out different pieces and you can have genes which can lead to lots of different proteins just depending on what you splice out. And for example, our immune system is done. I mean, that is critical because the immune system has to come up with lots of proteins which all look sort of dissimilar, but all bind to something different because you want to recognize all sorts of intruders. And for that, it's sort of crucial to have this mechanism which can combine things in different ways. So, I mean, is it useless to have that stuff? It's certainly not useless, even if this doesn't really code for anything in between. Okay.
Well, you're just saying that the junk in the middle is used as a spacer, in effect. Where
right.
So you could do that if half the gene were junk.
It also is always a question on what your pressure is on keeping the length short. I mean, if there's not a whole lot of evolutionary pressure, so what? And that is certainly different from organism to organism. I mean, if you look at viruses or bacteria, they have much more condensed, I mean, much less junk in their genome because for them it's harder to keep all that stuff together.
Some of these lengths are really mechanical, right? So like if... You know, the star sequence is 16 or 30 away from
the protein, so I guess it goes again. Right. They're really lengths where it's just, you need that much space to get some mechanical space in the system. Okay, so let me get to a little bit of physics. So that's all biology here. And of course, all the biologists, want to understand how all these things play together, and we also want to look at that and see if physics can help there. There are basically two aspects of biologically inspired physics, biophysics, however you want to word it. One is study the actual interactions between biomolecules. At the end, all of these things, I mean, if a protein binds to a DNA or not, within a protein, the interactions between the amino acids, within an RNA, the interactions between the bases, these are, at the end, all physical interactions, which together form this marvelous chemical computer. So one way of looking at things is to actually understand these interactions and what they need to. The other strand is to apply physics methods to bioinformatics or the theory of biological information. And I hope that I will be able to show you an example each of those two today. So this is, sort of real physical interactions. Here, what we basically do is we study things which are being used in order to handle biological information, basically computer algorithms which are being used as biological information, interpret them as a physical system, and once we have done that, apply all the tools which we've learned in physics in order to hopefully come to a result which is interesting for the people that are using those. Why should we be doing that, and why should we be doing that now? Biology obviously has been around for a long time. Is it just that the physicists ran completely out of physics problems, or is there a little bit more behind that? And I think there are basically a lot of pretty recent developments in experimental techniques which now make it useful for physicists to look at these things. There are first of all experimental physics developments, mainly the single molecule experiments, where people, for example, are now able to look into their microscope using so-called optical tweezer, which is a complicated laser system, in order to attach a little bead at some place in there where they can look at, and to move this thing around. And this bead can be sort of connected to some biopolymer, and maybe we have a protein binding on that, and the other end can be connected to another bead, and then they can pull on that and look how it reacts. They can, for example, if this is something which wants to move, they can see how this thing moves. And there are lots of marvelous experimental techniques now out where you can actually study isolated biomolecules in action. Right? And this is something which hasn't been around 5 or 10 years ago. And this basically gives us sort of now reproducible experiments on these biomolecules, which is of course one thing. If you want to understand these physical interactions, you first of all want to have reproducible experiments which you can then start describing. On the other hand, we have biological information, and also there the technology has grown a lot, and that basically relates to this. You all probably have heard about the Human Genome Project, and it was all over the press. We basically have the complete human genome. If you look at the database of known genes, you have 8 billion base pairs in there. That's obviously not only human. We have 30 complete genomes. It's probably a little more by now. Just to show you how this looks like, I brought you this picture from the website of the NCBI, that's the National Center for Biotechnology Information, which hosts GeneBank, the database where if you have any publication which contains a sequence, you have to submit it to them before it's even accepted in any paper. And these are the base pairs in millions. This is only 1999 back here, so this slide is already lowered. But now we are at 8 billion, and you see the growth of the number of base pairs and the growth of the number of sequences in this database. And it's obviously an exponential growth, and actually, and the time constant, the doubling time constant, is about 18 months, which is faster than Moore's law for the speed of computers. So there's no lack of information. There's another very recent, I should have left it down. There's another recent experimental technique, which is called the gene chip arrays. And this is what we talked about a lot sometime in March. What you see here is a silicon chip, And on this ship, without explaining to you the exact technique, they planted for every single gene in yeast a marker. And I told you that within that this whole cell is a big chemical computer, which the states of which are described by a protein is there or a protein is not there. And this chip can, in parallel, for all the 6,000 genes in yeast, tell you which ones are currently there and which ones are currently not there. And then you can start looking at how this varies through the cell cycle, how this varies if you starve the thing, how it varies if you put whatever chemicals at this thing, and you can try, I mean, you get all this, these huge amounts.
This is marking the proteins.
Yeah, it's marking the mRNAs, actually. It's showing the mRNA. So they can, I mean, all the things which happen after mRNA, you don't see here.
So it's just marking which mRNAs
are currently there. And I mean, the idea is that should be at least well correlated with which proteins are currently there. So this is sort of a big debugger where you can watch your computer going along.
Is it true that for every gene you can develop marker which will distinguish them?
Okay, this works only if you have a full, complete genome of the organism, because you have to, you have to first of all...
Physically possible.
Yeah, I mean, all which is done here is you put single-stranded DNA on the chip. You plant it mechanically on the chip, and you work at conditions. Okay, if you now put an mRNA in there, if it's exactly complementary, it will stick to it. If it's not exactly complementary, it will not stick to it. That's how they choose their conditions, right? And, I mean, okay, it's not the trivial problem to choose which pieces you now want to look for. You probably want to have things which do not just differ by one single base on a chip. And it's, I mean, there are lots of experimental tricks to that, and it's far from being a perfect technique. But, I mean, this data is out there, and it's getting better and better.
And if it sticks, how do you know it's there?
Oh, you label them. You label them with a fluorescent or radioactive marker, and then you go with your sensor across the ship, and you see what's there and what's not there. Okay, so I always like to sort of compare that phenomenon here with if you would do high-energy physics experiments, and you would post your terabyte of raw data of your detectors on the web, you write a paper about it and say, okay, here's the data, you do something with that, right? So that's sort of the situation we have here. It's not terabytes, it's only 3 billion bases for a human. But it's sort of a very different situation, because, I mean, it's like really data is being generated, but everybody is sort of invited to do something with it.
Are there simple toy models? I mean, instead of humans, that's the simplest thing. If you have similar genes, can you solve some system?
I don't know of any system which is solved. I mean, obviously people do not try.
By a solution,
I would. I mean, there are people who, for example, try to simulate on a computer a whole cell, meaning they put all the protein. And of course, you don't start with a human cell for different reasons. I mean, it's too complicated. Plus, doing experiments is sort of hard, right? You want to avoid all the trouble of doing human experiments and do something with whatever. Yeast or E. coli, which replicates fast and which is cheap. But I mean, yeah, as far as I know, I mean, it is a progress that now people are trying to do quantitative predictions, but so far they can only be falsified by experiment.
So there's nothing like a worm where you can actually now track everything that happens with it and change something and know what will change
No, we are certainly not there. I mean, that's certainly, I mean, the grand goal, but I mean, as far as I know, there are no quantitative predictions of. And I mean, people are now trying to, in some physics labs actually, to isolate sort of a very simple circuit. So, say, take something artificial which only contains certain genes and we know sort of how to interact and try to measure what's going on there, in order to produce something which is simpler than just a huge cell, and understand that first. Okay. Okay, so how it's already sort of late. So I'm wondering, I mean, I want to show you one example each, so I'm not quite sure what I should do. I mean, I first wanted to tell you something about DNA denaturation, which is sort of the simplest thing you can think of, right? You have these the bindings between the bases, and if you heat this thing up, eventually it will fall apart because we have only hydrogen bonds which bind the bases together, and this they are just not stable at higher temperatures, like 80, 90 degrees Celsius. The advantage of that is you can actually do this on the board. The disadvantage is it's already from the 1950s, 60s, so it's not really any hot stuff. I don't know, maybe I should skip that since it's not really that important. And maybe I'd rather tell you something about RNA folding, which is something which we are looking at currently this week in our workshop. Okay, so the RNA, let's go back to that. So you have a sequence. And now we basically just work with sequences. We forget most of the physical, biological, chemical properties of this object. And okay, let's say we have the sequence, and RNA and DNA, the difference is, one of the differences is that we have something called uracil here instead of the T, but they're chemically basically same. Okay, this thing now has to do something in order to fulfill these Watson-Crick base pairs, and what it does, it has to fold back into itself. And if I would have done it in a smart way, A's and U's want to pair, and U's and A's want to pair, and what this thing can, for example, do is we can start here with the A, the U, G, C, C, G, A, U, and then, I don't know, this was not very smart, my sequence, but so, for example, if this thing falls back into itself, it can take advantage of these two Watson-Crick base pairs here. And obviously, there are lots of different ways it could do that. And the structure in which this thing will fold, finally, is determined by, basically, that's what people believe, by the minimum energy structure. Right? So for every Watson-Crick base pair, the first approximation, we just gain some energy. Orders of magnitude here are for an AU base pair, sort of 2 kT at room temperature. GC base pair is something on the order of 4 kT at room temperature. That's what you gain if you form the Watson-Crick base pair. And then you can basically look at all possibilities to form base pairs in a sequence like that and try to look for the lowest energy one.
So this is much simpler than protein.
Exactly. In proteins, the W half is that every amino acid has like six neighbors if it's somewhere in the middle, and it interacts with every single one of those. In RNA folding, once you have a pair, you're completely happy, and everything else that happens is sort of a higher order perturbation on that. And that's why RNA folding, I personally find that RNA folding is a nice sort of toy problem. It's not a complete toy problem since there are real RNAs around and you can study them, but it's a problem which is similar to protein folding in the sense that you can understand how does sequence lead to structure, but it's on the other hand much easier. Well, why is it much easier? If you take we have something maybe a little bit more interesting here, a structure like that, let me not specify the sequence. If you take the ends of this RNA molecule and pull them apart, then what you end up is the following. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. So now we keep the base pairs and draw them as these new charges. I hope it works.
What?
Larger.
There should be three left in here, Okay, so what happens? We get a diagram like that. And if we argue that we can forget structures, that for example this guy and this guy are bound to each other, and there are some kinetic reason why you want to do that, basically you say, well, they happen in biology, but they don't happen too often, and I also count them as sort of a higher order perturbation. So if we do that, then every single possible RNA structure is can be described by a diagram of these arches, and these arches will never cross, right? So now we can say, okay, we assign an energy to every structure S, which is just the sum over the base pairs part of the structure, and then some energy epsilon ij, which, for example, is minus 2 kt if I, the base at I and base at j are an AU base pair, is minus 4 kt if the bases at I and j are GC base pairs, and that's it. So that's not a very faithful description of RNA energies, and you can actually do quantitative modeling where there are hundreds of energy parameters. They all have all been measured. But I mean, I just want to do the simple model to give you a flavor.
It's too small a system for anthropic considerations to be important. Is the energy not the free energy that you
care
about?
Okay. That now depends on what you're asking. But first of all, these so-called energies are actually free energies for every base pairing. Because the way you measure them is the difference between an unbound base and a bound base. And that difference definitely contains a loss of entropy in a single strand. So these things will actually be temperature-dependent energy parameters. They are free energies. There are other forms of entropy in here. For example, the fact that we have three unbound bases here. They are free to flop around in three-dimensional space. So there is an entropy coming with that, especially with closing the loop of length 3, which you in principle should take into account, which you can take into account if you want to, if you're interested in quantitative predictions. And on top of that, there is another free energy, and that is the free energy of different ways of bonding. I just showed you now the energy for one single structure. Of course, if you want to do statistical physics, what we want to do is take the sum over all structures and every structure being weighted with its corresponding energy or free energy. And that gives you another sort of entropy which if you do this scheme, you can take it into account.
How important is the bending energy of these
calculations? These are single-stranded RNA, when they're unbound here.
Yeah.
And in that case, the persistence length is sort of on the order of three bases, so it's very short. It does play a role, for example, you should not really be allowed to do arches which are shorter than three bases if you want to do quantitative prediction. If you're just interested in sort of what physicists are interested in, at least statistical physicists are interested in, like phase transitions, critical exponents, you would think that doesn't matter, right? If you want to do quantitative description, then you have to take that serious. And also, if you have a short loop, you would have an energy contribution to that, which comes from the bending energy and so on and so forth.
Yes,
yeah,
so you said something I was confused by. You said the arches shouldn't cross. Maybe explain this. Why? I mean, we're working in three dimensions, right?
Well, we are working in three dimensions, yes. It is an approximation that the arches shouldn't cross. You forbid things which connect two bases like that we have two base pairs which interact like that. But that is called a pseudonaut. The reason to do that is, you don't see them too often. And why don't you see them too often? Now let me try if I get my helices better. No?
Okay.
Okay, RNA also forms the same double helix as DNA. It's just the one molecule which goes around. Okay? Okay, so what I wanted to draw here now. Okay, so I mean, it locally forms the same structure. It's just not the long double helix, but instead you have double helix, then you have a piece of floppy stuff, and double helix, and a piece of floppy stuff, and so on and so forth. So if you want to do a pseudonaut, then it would three-dimensionally look somehow. Come and see what that is. This is floppy. You have a helix here, you have a helix here, and this is the pseudonaut here. Right? I took the two loops here and made a knot out of them. But either the pseudonaut is short and takes only like, well, there are 10 bases in a whole turn. So if you are like at 5 bases, then you can do it without a construction like that. But that doesn't give you too much energetic contribution, so you say, okay, I leave those for later on and try to find a structure without that. If you want to have something really long, then you would have to do this helix, and then you would, I mean, this is kinetically hard for the molecule to do. This thing you can only construct by really taking the end and threading it through, and that won't happen. Okay?
So you can just take that planar loop and then just twist
exactly.
It.
If there are no double strand, then you just can twist it up and down, and that's kinetically easy. But, I mean, to get this, you're really in trouble. So if that is your simplest model of RNA, you want to know the partition function. And as you know, obviously there are exponentially many structures around. And that looks, well, first of all, pretty discouraging. And for protein folding, that is indeed discouraging. But the nice thing is for RNA folding, there is something better. And that is the following equation. This should now denote the partition function for the bases, for the strand, substrand from base I to base J. So that means the sum of all possibilities to put arches on top of that without having them cross. Well, what is this partition function? We definitely can first look at just base number J and see what base number J is doing. Okay, base number J could be unbound. In that case, if base number J is unbound, we still can put all possible arches between I and J minus 1, right? Or base number J could be bound to some base number K. This is obviously all possibilities we have. And then we can still have all possible arches in here, and we can have all possible arches out here. But these can never bind to each other because of a non-crossing condition. So this may look familiar to some people. Right? It's a Hartree equation. So that looks as if you could do some nice physics with that. Computational biologists knew that also for a long time because this is a convenient algorithm which allows you to calculate the full partition function of an RNA sequence, given RNA sequence, or if you, instead of a sum here, say I make it do a minimum operation, it allows you to calculate the minimum free energy structure of an RNA molecule in polynomial time. It's n to the third. And that's, of course, much better than exponential. So why is it n to the third? Well, on the right-hand side, all pieces of partition function are shorter than the one on the left-hand side. So you start with a single base partition function. That's trivial. The two base partition function are just the sum of not bound or bound. And then you iterate that going to longer and longer pieces. And eventually you're at Z1m. And that is your final partition function. And since you have to do that n squared times, and for each one sum over and one index, it's an n to the third algorithm. Okay, this algorithm, you can actually include a lot of the energetics here. So I already said there are tons of energetics known of about this problem. And although this specific way to write the algorithm depends on my energy here, after all, I want that this the energy for this arch is independent of what happens next to them. There are some smart ways to introduce that. And there are basically two software packages around. One is called Mfold, and one is the Vienna package. And well, we have Peter Schuster here, who is one of the authors of the Vienna package. And these packages actually allow you to predict secondary structures of RNA with a, I mean, not with 100%, but I mean, they work very well, especially compared to what you know from protein folding.
But I know there's always
well, it certainly depends on what you're looking at. I mean, if for example, for an mRNA, you wouldn't even expect it to be for other RNA sequences which are structural, I mean at least the overall structure is certainly unique. And the way you usually can tell is by taking RNA sequences from many organisms and comparing them. And if you see at one position you have sort of maybe an A here and a U here in the sequence of one, and then you see another one has mutated from an A to a C, G, but at the same time here it has mutated from U to a C, then you know, boy, these two guys must be a base pair in the real structure, and that's sort of the best method to actually determine secondary structure.
But the structure itself is crystallography.
Crystallography is one method, but it's very hard because it's much floppier than proteins. So even crystallizing this thing, I mean, I think that, I mean, they have some RNA structures, crystallography, but I mean, this is really the method of choice. Of course, this doesn't tell you anything about the tertiary structure, really. I mean, the way, once you have these base pairs, this thing will do something in three dimensions, and that, it won't tell you. Okay. So things you can look at now, and that is something which I and several other people in Terry's group have been worked about, is how you can sort of make a phase diagram of RNA if you just take this simple model. One axis here is the temperature, of course, and the other axis here is what we call the bias. Bias being sort of how much is this thing designed to fold into what it's supposed to fold into for biological reasons, the so-called native sequence. If you look at no bias, that means completely random sequences, what you find is you have a denatured phase at high temperatures. At high temperatures, everything falls apart. At lower temperatures, you see that there is a coexistence, or can be a coexistence, of different compact states, but it doesn't quite know which structure to fold into. Well, that's what protein people like to call this modern globular phase. You see something similar in RNA. What's not quite sure is if there may be a glass phase, and that has been sort of under discussion. There are only one structure, only a few structures actually contribute to the ensemble. And then if you start designing a sequence for some special structure, for example, just a long hairpin, then at some point, if you do that strong enough, you will find this sequence to be the predominant, this structure to be the predominant one, and then you can start studying this phase diagram here. You can look at this phase transition, this phase transition, this phase transition. You can describe critical exponents there and all sorts of things. Once you realize that you have this very nice equation here, and that is, I mean, this you can actually really do analytically in some way, and of course you can also do numerics very easily.
Bias has got to be a projection of a multidimensional space.
Yeah, the bias is a sort of difficult quantity to really pin down. I mean, in our models, we sort of use, if we do numerics, what we do is we really pick something which is completely complementary for one sequence and then go away from that limitation. In analytical calculations, what we do is we say, well, all bonds attract each other equally well, but there are some bonds, the ones which are in the native structure, which are a little stronger, and that's called a Go model. I mean, to actually determine what the bias is, if you would just look at the sequence, that's a sort of difficult question, yes. Okay. Things you would like to know here, I mean, this is really just a very elementary thing, but people are interested in, we heard a little bit about that in our workshop. For example, you want to know what are excluded volume effects. I mean, these things actually have to live in three dimensions somehow. If they come close to each other, they could interact, right? does that change any of it? That's physics here. Also, can we understand this glass phase here? I mean, if you just take random sequences, what does this RNA do? Another thing is these pseudonuts here, right? How do we describe these pseudonuts? Can one take them into account either in these quantitative predictions or in these analytic calculations? Kinetics of RNA is one big area which is not really a whole lot known about, but which definitely, I mean, if you think about this thing, has to fold in biology somehow in a reasonable time, is also one of the areas which are currently under investigation.
Is there some reason why biologists would be interested in critical exponents?
No. No, there's. I don't think so. I mean, I'm not aware. And this is biologically inspired physics, right? It's sort of it's a very pretty problem, mm-hmm. and biologists certainly would be interested if you could tell them something about the, for example, self-avoidance, how they can take that into their quantitative models and so on and so forth. But I mean, I see it just as. I mean, it is a simple toy problem where you can sort of think about questions like how does structure formation work, how much design do you need in order to fold into a design structure and things like that in a very, very well-defined framework. And I mean, if you can calculate exponents, then you can calculate them, but I don't think a biologist would care about that. But that's why I want to tell you about this other area, if I'm allowed maybe another 10 minutes. And that is using physics to study bioinformatics problems, because that's something biologists definitely care about. So if you ask a protein folding person, why are they doing protein folding? Well, they will immediately tell you, well, the sequence determines the structure determines the function, and I'm interested in the function, so I first have to understand what the structure is. Okay. Most biologists will tell you that's actually not the way they work. Since protein folding is not solved, what they do for now is they try to determine function from the sequence without looking at the structure. And how do they do that? Well, they have done experiments for, 20, 30 years, or even longer, on specific sequences, and they have found out what they do. And now we have this huge database, 8 billion base pairs, and for many things in there, it is actually biologically known what they do. So now you find your new sequence. What you do is you compare this new sequence to the database of already known sequences. You hope that you find something which is similar to your new sequence. And once you do, you conclude that probably this new thing does the same as what the old sequence of the database already did. Or you ask, is that always safe? No, it's not always safe. Is it a good idea to first do the biological experiment to confirm that, as opposed to just randomly doing biological experiments in order to find a function? It's certainly a good idea. Right? So this is a very important question. How do you compare biological sequences with each other? And this question is so important that the algorithm called BLAST, which is doing that on the website at the NCBI, the paper which presents this algorithm happens to be the most cited paper in all of science in the last 10 years. That is not because everybody reads that paper, but it is because everybody cites the paper who uses BLAST for comparison. And I mean, that's every molecular biologist who finds a new sequence, first thing, go to the NCBI website and BLAST. And we had 2 weeks ago Steve Marshall here for 2 days, and he was one of the main authors of this paper. So how does it work? Let's say we have two sequences, and mostly people look for protein sequences. I will use as an example only the DNA sequences. And let's say we have this sequence. So as you can see, these two have a similarity because they share this piece, and that might be a sign that they are evolutionarily related. You also see that we have the same A here, and we have the same G here. And that can also be a sign of the evolutionary relationship, because during evolution it is possible that pieces of sequence are being inserted or deleted out of a sequence. So if we want to find similarity, we have to take that into account. And a possible comparison of these two sequences, which seems to be a particularly good one, is to insert these little gaps in here. Which brings lots of identical letters on top of each other. Obviously, there are lots of ways to do so, and we have to compare them. But in order to compare them, we have to calculate some number which tells us how good this comparison is. And what we do is we say, well, this is a plus one if it's an identical letter, it's a minus delta for a gap, it's a plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one. Okay, now, I, of course, should have added something. Let's say we have an A and a T here, and these two both just don't match, so we call it minus mu. And mu and delta are two parameters of this algorithm. In general, if we want to compare proteins, we have to be much more sophisticated, because different amino acids, there are some which are very similar and some which are very dissimilar. So if you have two which are not identical but still similar, you would still give a sort of positive score. If something is really dissimilar, you would give a negative score. So you end up, since there are 20 amino acids, with a 20 by 20 matrix of scores. But I mean, in order to explain what's going on, let's stick to the simple model. We have a plus one for every match when they are identical, a minus delta for every gap, and a minus mu for every mismatch. So, for every way to put in gaps here, we can calculate a score, which is just the sum over those, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 minus mu minus 2 delta in this case. Now you can imagine I could put in gaps at a different place and I would get a different score. And what, of course, is the best way to compare them is the thing which gives us the best score. How do we calculate the best score? We calculate the best score by writing these two sequences at the edges of this grid. We may not go all the way to the end. And now we say at every node of this grid, we calculate the score of the best comparison which ends at this point. So here, which only compares A and A, and since we have a plus one here, the score would be plus one here. Here, on this bond, we write a minus mu because the A and the C are a mismatch. Okay, these things are minus deltas, because they correspond to gaps. If we pair one thing with nothing in the other sequence. So now if you want to calculate the score in this point here, we know that we have only three possibilities to get here. One would be the one minus delta, one would be the minus delta minus mu, and the other one, okay, is the minus three delta here, and so most probably on this node, we would have 1 minus delta as our score. And you see that you can do that recursively from the upper left corner going all the way down. And you can recursively calculate what's the best score for all possibilities to align these two subsequences, to put all gaps into these subsequences. And eventually, you'll end up down here, and the number which you have down here is the score of the best alignment of the total sequences. So this may now again look very familiar to some physicists. Namely, what you can do is you can draw a coordinate system like that. You can say, aha, here is time running down this way. There is space running down this way. And for every alignment, we can draw a path starting here. A, for this one, A is aligned to A, G is aligned to nothing, C is aligned to C, T is aligned to T, and so on and so forth, and this path would and down somewhere down there. And so we can say, well, this path is the word line of some particle going from this corner to this corner, this being the coordinate, it's a one-dimensional thing, and this being time. So what do these cores then use? Well, these cores are basically energies which this particle collects while it goes through the space. So in a sort of continuous way, you can write the energy of this thing as being the integral, and then you would like to write that as a dr by dt squared. That term just means, well, you can only go sort of diagonal. You cannot do extremely large steps. They will be forbidden. And then along these lines, you will have your collective for energies, and these energies are in some sense random and depend on where you are at which time, right? Because that describes along which bond you're going, and the total energy you collect is just the sum of the energies of all the bonds you traversed. Okay, so if that's the energy, then you can again associate with that a partition function by just integrating over all possible paths and just weighting everything with a Boltzmann factor. If you want, you can put a temperature here. Okay. This, again, is a well-known physics problem. It is the directed polymer in a random potential. Right? This thing by itself would be called the directed polymer. You can say it's just a one-dimensional random block. And this thing here is the random potential, which this is subject to. And all these alignment algorithms do is they in some sense try to find the minimum energy path in this specific lattice. So now, what's the question for the biologists, right? I mean, these alignment algorithms are known since 1970. The question is the following. This algorithm, for every pair of sequences, will give you a number. I mean, it's just an algorithm. I just start in the corner and go to the other corner. Every pair of sequences will produce you some number. Now, okay, if this number could be 10, or it could be 100, or maybe minus 10, when should a biologist now believe that these things are actually biologically related, right? If I'm sort of mean, I create a random sequence with my favorite, a favorite random number generator, I submit it to GeneBank. And I mean, it obviously doesn't mean anything when we hit that sequence, right? So what the biologists want to know is how probable it is for, if they get a certain score, a certain energy here, that this actually has some biological meaning. And that's what they call the p-value. That is just the probability of finding this score by chance.
Then you choose the lambda mu.
Oh.
Delta mu.
The delta mu, well, that's a difficult question, yeah.
The E value depends on that.
For a given pair of sequences, what you maybe want to do is choose the delta mu such that the p-value is lowest. Right? Otherwise, I mean, how people usually choose it, somebody tells them that out of experience, these are the best values. And this is what everybody uses, right? The default values which BLAST comes with is what everybody uses, basically. But I mean, obviously, I mean, there is a whole theory behind that, how you should choose those. And this theory, in the case of, I mean, if you don't have these gaps, then
you get different values when you have different
muse.
Of course. So how does BLAST decide?
Oh, BLAST just uses one set of values.
I just choose
it. Why? I mean, Steve has been sitting down with large databases and has tried to find things in there and has decided that with Blossom 62 scoring matrix and 11-1 gap cuts, which is sort of a generalization of these mu and deltas, that's in general the best. And that's what people mostly use. But I mean, yeah, right? I mean, that's the question how to choose that is...
How can I choose the next delta?
Steve Archula dies tomorrow, I'll just the next essay.
Well, actually, somebody else who looks at them. No, I mean, seriously, I mean, that, to find a way to choose mu and delta is certainly one of the most important things when you want to do a good theory of that stuff. I mean, if you don't have gaps, then you actually know how to choose mu and delta. If you have an idea what you're looking for. If you have gaps, then currently there is no real working theory of how you should choose mu and delta. Yes. But that's something which you try to achieve by using these physics methods. They actually get to a theory of gaps and lines and find out how to choose them.
Presumably, to decide how to choose those, you need to know something about
a biological
information encoded in the genome.
Right. I mean,
you want to say these two are close, therefore.
Yes.
Or you need to know something about the theory of evolution.
Right. You have to. I mean, if things are closely related, you might want to choose a different, whereas than if they are very unrelated. But on the other hand, things are closely related. I mean, that's sort of the reasoning behind the steam hydrogen story. If things are closely related, it doesn't really matter if you choose the wrong one; that you still find it. You may not find it optimally, but still find it. If things are very loosely related, then it's important to have the right mu and delta. So what Steve is doing is basically he chooses parameters which are sort of in this twilight zone where it's sort of getting really hard to find similarities which work optimally for things which are related in this area. So that's the reasoning behind what he's doing. It's not a complete guesswork, but. Okay, to make the long story short, if you want to know what the p-value is, you obviously have to know what the distribution of scores is, or the distribution of energies is, and without going into the actual details, I mean, the algorithm actually works still a little bit differently from what I told you, because people are not really interested in finding the best score for the whole length, but in sort of finding the best pieces which match to each other. You can calculate into a similar algorithm, and what you find is, numerically, if you plot the distribution of the score as a function of the score, it is an extreme value distribution. And it looks like that. Okay, this is not the density, that's the integrated form. If you differentiate that with respect to S, you get this thing. So that is numerically very well established, and that's the distribution. And so all you have to do is actually calculate this K and this lambda. And for gapless alignment, if you don't allow these gaps here, there's actually some since 1990 a complete mathematically rigorous theory of what K and lambda should be in the presence of gap, as there is no such analytical theory. But what you can do actually using this sort of analogy here to directed polymers in random medium is in specific cases actually calculate in some approximations what the value of this lambda would be. The value of K is much harder, but K is not so bad, right? So how this looks like is it has a tail of the form e to the minus lambda s, and this the maximum here is somewhere, I think, at log k over lambda. So if you're off with lambda, you are really describing this tail very badly. And remember, you are interested in the tail of this distribution. We have lots of sequences, let's say 100,000 sequences. And we want, so if something has a probability of 10 to the minus 5, that would still show up by chance one time in a database search, because I compared 100,000 times. So what I really want to know is how does this distribution look very, very, very far out in the tail. Well, and so, I mean, if K is wrong, I mean, okay, this thing is shifted, but if lambda is wrong, we're really off out in the tail. So you can actually come up with sort of approximate formulas for this lambda. In some simple cases, you can come up with at least fast numerical schemes to calculate that. The brute force way to just take a lot of random sequences, align them, and take this distribution takes very long because you have, you want to get out into an exponential tail and get the value of this tail very well. So that's a very slow numerical method, so you can come up with faster numerical methods using this analogy here. And that's something we have been doing, and by now, BLAST, or the default values of lambda and k for BLAST are now already being calculated. with the methods which we have been proposing, and we're still trying to get better with more and more scoring systems for which we can actually calculate lambda. And also we now devise an algorithm which is sort of a variation of what I showed you, for which lambda is always equal to 1, completely independent of the scoring system. Okay, at this point I think I better stop and leave it to the next speaker in 2 weeks to tell you a little bit more about what we're doing here. Thank you.